today on Against the Grain. Many people on the left have come to believe that we can and should change the world without taking power. Paul Christopher Gray has a different take. I'm C.S. Gray, who teaches political science and labor studies, discusses his new book, From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The state, many on the radical left believe, the state is corrupt and undemocratic. It is, in this country and so many others, obedient to and ultimately controlled by the capitalist class. So what's the use, the argument goes, of engaging with the state? What's the use of electoral politics, of trying to change the system from within, of attempting to reform the capitalist system and state to make it a bit gentler around the edges? Fundamental social and political transformation, many leftists argue, must come from outside state institutions. People, ordinary people, must create their own institutions, must create the world they want to see, and not get their hands dirty with the business of running and joining political parties that vie for state power. It's a compelling argument, but one that my guest finds deficient in certain respects. Paul Christopher Gray teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. And his new book, his new edited book, is From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. When Paul Christopher Gray joined me recently, I asked what motivated him to produce this volume.
I would say about 9 or 10 years ago, I came to believe that capitalist society is an inherently unequal society, and that those inequalities were the result of being historically imposed rather than the result of any natural inequalities or hierarchies within humankind. So I got politically active and was trying to see if there might be alternatives to capitalism, because if indeed capitalism is inherently unequal or unjust, there might not be an alternative that is better to it, and we might just have to reform capitalism as best we can. And I think one of the most influential ideas that I encountered early on while I was getting politically active and looking for alternatives was something like Holloway's slogan, "Change the world without taking power." And I think we can refer to this tendency, this milieu, as a kind of anti-power politics. Essentially, what it means is the state, the government, the most powerful institutions in our society are inherently illegitimate and co-opting. And so, therefore, if we are going to try to transform society for the better, we should avoid these institutions at all costs. We should try to build alternatives outside of them.
Holloway is John Holloway, who in 2002 wrote a book called Change the World Without Taking Power. So, yeah, let's spend a little time on Holloway, because you, in this book, push back against what he is saying, what he is arguing. So he does not want to engage with the state. He does not believe in electoral politics or this idea, this ambition of winning government office. So tell us more about what kinds of institutions and organizing he would like to see happen, or he thinks needs to happen in order to change the world.
Well, what's interesting about John Holloway is that in the 70s and the 80s, he was actually one of the most articulate defenders of the idea of trying to work both in and against the state, both inside and against government, outside of government as well. And sometime during the 1990s, he had a change of heart. And I think that this was inspired in large part by the Zapatistas in the southernmost state of Mexico, in Chiapas. And they had attempted to create an autonomous region which the government and military forces were not able to enter so that they could engage in forms of self-governance. And Holloway theorized this and tried to generalize it so that it could be implemented beyond the Zapatista experience. And in doing so, he tapped into a longer-term tradition of what you might describe as dual power or diarchy or autonomism. There are a variety of different names and sub-traditions within it. But generally, the idea is that because electoral politics is not genuinely representative, because the government or the state is an institution based primarily in coercion and is unaccountable to the broader population, and because the government and the state as a set of institutions seem to co-opt and to subvert the principles of everyone who would try to change the world for the better by using them, by operating within them, this broader tradition that Holloway is tapping into attempts to create institutions that are an alternative to the state. So it might be a network of more democratic unions, of neighborhood councils, of workers' councils, where workers are actually creating committees and fighting for demands beyond economic demands like wage increases, but for more participation in the decisions of the actual companies that they work for, cooperatives, militias, and the like. And ultimately, the goal is, in one way or another, to create these alternative institutions in the shadows of the state and en masse to withdraw from our acquiescence to government, to the state, and to contend for power with it by asking people to participate in these alternative institutions.
How influential has this anti-power politics been or become among radical leftists?
I would say that it has been quite influential. I think that something like anti-power politics has been quite influential for parts of the new left in the 1960s and the 1970s. I think it was quite popular for the anti-globalization or the ultra-globalization or the global justice movements in the 90s. I think that it was quite influential in the Occupy and Squares movements of the 2000s and 2010s. And I think to a certain extent it is influential today, although potentially the pendulum is shifting in the other direction.
And I think I interrupted you earlier when you were talking about kind of the motivation of writing this book. So is the intention of this book to somehow pose an alternative to what Holloway is urging the left to do?
I would say it's not merely an alternative to what Holloway is arguing for, because I think that many who argue for anti-power politics offer some good criticisms of those on the radical left, including social democrats, socialists, and certain parts of the communist tradition. They offer good criticisms of their attempts to change the world by taking state power. And so what I think the authors in this book attempt to do is reconcile the best aspects of both of these traditions, the tradition that is wary of co-optation by the state, and the tradition that thinks, nonetheless, we have to engage with the state, we have to act through the state in certain ways, even if that is not the entirety of our strategy.
What has the left, or large parts of it, concluded about the wisdom of developing, of coming up with a single, encompassing, long-term strategy for achieving its goals of a more just world?
Well, I think that often the attempt to create a all-encompassing, long-term strategy is open to genuine criticism. I think that often political parties of the left, whether they be social democratic, socialist, or communist, have often attempted to create this collective strategy, this long-term strategy, in highly reductionist ways. Reductionist in the sense that they neglect the diversity within the working class and what it would mean to create genuine solidarity between different groups of the working class, including the inequalities within the working class. It's often been reductionist in the ways in which it has neglected some of the other inequalities and oppressions that are just as integral to capitalism as is the class inequality between workers and capitalists. By this I mean ableism, ageism, racialization, patriarchy, colonialism, imperialism, sexism, heteronormativity, and the like. And so I think that there are excellent criticisms made of attempts to do this. On the other hand, I think that we should be aspiring less to a kind of fragmentation of our politics along different categories of difference. We should be aspiring to a politics that is rooted in universal principles, something that does not want to achieve unity by imposing uniformity, something that is not merely the party line of a rather undemocratic leftist party, but nevertheless something that has universal principles based on a fundamental equality of human beings.
Well, on this issue of kind of a long-term strategy, I mean, a lot of people associate that with communist parties in the past, socialist parties, social democratic parties operating in various nations. How would you assess the state and status of, for example, communist parties in the world today?
Well, I think the communist parties of the world today have a varied experience. Many of them have gone into decline or have disbanded altogether. Some of them have remained largely the same, engaging in orthodox Marxism of the old type, but have become quite marginal forces within their own societies. And then some of them are quite prominent, but communist in name only. And by this I mean, for example, the Chinese Communist Party, which for decades now has been making its own kind of authoritarian statist transition to capitalism.
And what about social democratic parties? How intent are they on moving their respective societies towards socialism?
Well, in the early to mid-20th century, the goal of many social democratic parties was to achieve a kind of socialist society, a society beyond capitalism, but to do so largely through parliamentary reforms. They would get elected, and they would attempt to gradually create socialism within capitalism. However, they encountered a number of barriers along the way, and we can talk about that in more detail later on if you would like. And generally, towards the mid and the end of the 20th century, the social democratic parties largely abandoned any attempt to fundamentally transform capitalist society. The goal ultimately was to create the best kind of capitalism possible, capitalism with a human face, as it was often referred to. The problem has been that social democratic parties, particularly in the new millennium, have essentially become the left wing of the neoliberal consensus. So it's not that they reject austerity policies that seek to cut the amount of money going to public services. It's not that they reject the privatization of many of these public services, the attempt to take public goods out of the public sector and to put them into the market. They haven't rejected this. They've only tried to ameliorate it. And I think we are seeing a decline of social democratic parties, especially among those that were the most influential within their own countries. And a part of this is a broader disenchantment with the mainstream establishment political parties, of which the social democratic parties are a part.
Paul Christopher Gray joins me. He teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada. He's editor of the new book, From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. It's published by State University of New York Press. So I want to get back to this question of autonomous institutions, pushed by people like John Holloway. And again, as you said earlier, examples of these are democratic unions, popular assemblies, cooperatives fit in there, workplace and neighborhood councils. Under what circumstances, and it's useful to look historically at the historical record, and you do this in the first chapter of your book, From the Streets to the State, looking at it historically, under what circumstances have autonomous institutions actually been able to vie with state institutions for legitimacy and popularity?
Well, I think this is one of the major problems with Holloway's attempt to make a general strategy, this idea of changing the world without taking power. Because the actual historical examples of these autonomous institutions being able to actually rival their national states is quite exceptional. It happens very rarely and only in a few set of circumstances. So it primarily happens after defeat in war. This was the case with the Paris Commune in the 19th century, with the Russian Soviets or the council governments in places like Hungary after the First World War. It also happens after defeat in colonial war, as was the case in Portugal in the 1970s. And it occurs when trying to struggle against the seizure of state power by fascist forces, as was the case in Spain in the 1930s. But this only occurred in places where parliamentary institutions were quite weak. The other examples where it hasn't happened as a result of the things that I've already laid out are places where it's only occurred in a single neighborhood or in a single fairly marginalized region, as is the case, you know, in autonomous institutions being single buildings that have been converted into squats in Berlin, for example, or certain neighborhoods within particular cities, such as Exarchia in Athens, or, as is the case with the Zapatistas and their considerable achievements, limited but considerable, in the southernmost region of Mexico. Now, don't get me wrong, I think that these institutions like democratic unions, workers' councils, neighborhood councils, people's assemblies, and the like are incredibly important. Whether these can actually create alternative institutions to the state, whether these can actually rival national states, the power of national states, that's what I'm more skeptical about.
And are the autonomous institutions you just mentioned, are they to some extent left alone by the state or tolerated by the state because of their limited size and scope?
Yes, I would think so. In the case of those autonomous institutions that have not been harassed or outright repressed by the state, it's usually because the state might not even be aware of their existence, or their existence is quite marginal and does not really reach that many people or call into question governance at any level, including the municipal level. Or, in rare circumstances, these autonomous institutions are perceived as a significant threat to the national state, and yet they have been unable to spread beyond the region in which they have existed for some time, and that includes the Zapatistas.
How big is the threat of state repression of autonomous institutions when they achieve a kind of significance and meaningful scale in terms of, you know, the area in which they operate?
Well, I think it's basically inevitable. If these autonomous institutions reach a certain size and a certain number of people, such that they do start to threaten the sovereignty of the national government institutions, that they will face various forms of harassment or repression. Harassment could include things like if these institutions are providing some needed services, say health services to local neighborhood they could be harassed over questions of licensing and whether they're adhering to the existing laws. But beyond that, I think all of these institutions at a certain point are subject to outright state repression. That's not to say that political parties that are engaging in electoral politics and attempting to transform the state by also operating within government aren't also subject to state repression in a variety of ways. Nevertheless, if you already have political power within government institutions, you can start to create allies and bastions of strength that might be able to mitigate some of this repression or win enough of an alliance between forces within the state and your allies beyond it to prevent it from occurring, at least in its most direct and repressive ways.
What about alliances with state workers? Is it important for autonomous institutions to form alliances? And I'm thinking about workers, and you were thinking about workers when you wrote this book, that provide public services?
Well, I think that this is a significant question. If an anti-power politics is trying to create alternative institutions that are entirely outside of government, outside of the state, that includes outside of the public sector. And I think that anti-power politics will confront a variety of challenges in its attempts to pull allegiance away from government institutions toward their own alternative, including from public sector workers whose livelihoods, their jobs, and the services that they provide to people who are in need will be negatively affected by this. And so anti-power politics is open to the prospect of immense sabotage by public sector workers, by state workers. More importantly, however, I think that those who are attempting to transform the world for the better can have a significant ally in these public sector workers. They can be allies on the inside of the state, so to speak. They will certainly be against the decomposition of government, but they might not be against the democratization of government. And in this, I've been influenced by the work of Carmen Siriani in particular. There are numerous examples of public sector workers being excellent allies for members of civil society who are outside of government institutions. So to take one example, this is a case study that's explored by Greg McElliott in the book. In the 1980s, Toronto immigration officers decided that they wanted to change how they went about their struggles to improve their working conditions. Now, immigration officers might not be the first group you think of for having progressive politics, but many of these workers, these public sector workers, decided that instead of following the normal channels of collective bargaining with the government, they were going to try to form alliances with immigrants and immigrants' rights groups with whom they, up until this point, had often had quite an antagonistic relationship. And so they decided to create coalitions in which members of the Immigration Officers Union, as well as members of these immigrants' rights groups, could participate as equal partners, talk about their mutual experiences, their mutual ideas, and try to overcome some of the divisions that had existed between them. And most importantly, try to come up with a collective strategy. And essentially, what they came up with was a work-to-rule campaign. The immigration officers decided that they were only going to see as many new applicants for immigration status as could reasonably be seen within a normal working day. Now, this meant that there were many applicants to immigration status who would not be seen over the course of that day. And had there been no prior work through this coalition, then this probably would have upset these immigrants' rights groups and immigration applicants greatly. But the point is that it put a lot of pressure on the government, especially when these immigrants' rights groups, applicants to new immigrant status, as well as social movements groups, joined the makeshift picket lines that had been formed around this Work to Rule campaign by the immigration officers. And it got national coverage in Canada and proved to provide so much pressure that the government was forced to hire 280 new immigration officers so that they could actually have enough people to do the job well, to actually consider the applications for immigration status for new immigrants to Canada. I think that this is an excellent example of the way in which public sector workers can be allies, and I think potentially it could be extended. Why not go beyond temporary coalitions? Why not begin to construct councils, permanent organizations where public sector workers in various fields reach out to the user groups who depend on the services that they provide and get both to participate in councils where they can discuss how the services should be provided, what kind of resources would be necessary to provide them in the right way, and to come up with collective strategies that can put pressure on the existing political parties to expand and to improve the public sector and public services.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Paul Christopher Gray joins me. He teaches at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. And his new book is From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. He has edited the book and written a chapter in it. Contributors include people like Leo Panitch and Greg Albo and Hillary Wainwright and many others. To continue kind of with the issue of autonomous institutions and what they can and cannot do within society, right, apart from the state, not engaging with the state, what should be said about their ability to raise the money and resources needed to carry out their functions, especially if they grow beyond the local scale?
Well, this, I think, is a major shortcoming of strategies to try to build these autonomous institutions beyond local scales. Because as soon as you attempt to do so, you are going to run into problems of how are you going to raise enough money, enough revenues, to be able to provide the kinds of services that people need in our society. And so I think that the attempt to create these autonomous institutions beyond the local level will always face a fiscal crisis. And I'm skeptical about the idea of attempting to organize a mass tax strike or tax withdrawal and then putting the funds towards these alternatives to the already existing government institutions, not only because this would be extremely difficult to organize and would face all sorts of repression from government, but also it could have potentially chaotic effects that would have the most immediate and dire impacts on the people who depend on the public services that are paid for by these taxes.
Now, you counterpose the anti-power politics group with kind of the tendency that wants to engage and does engage with the state. You call this parliamentarism. And you write that for this tendency, the state is democratic. It embodies universal liberties, not the power of the capitalist class and elite groups. So this tendency argues that the radical left can use the state to fully realize its liberties in ways that preserve the continuity between the partial democracy permitted under capitalism and the full democracy allowed by socialism. I guess my question is, to what degree do you think the state in a capitalist society can be considered to be kind of separate from the capitalist class, can be considered to be, to have some kind of independence from what the capitalist class wants and desires?
Well, I think one of the essays in the book that tackles this question quite well is written by Thomas Chiasson-Labelle. And before his analysis of the pink tide governments in Latin America, and in particular in Venezuela and Ecuador, he asked the question, to what extent is the state autonomous from the ruling classes, the elite groups, from the capitalist class in the capitalist societies? And he goes through some of the debates. He disagrees with liberals, for example, who believe that the state is more or less autonomous from all of the groups in society, or insofar as it is influenced by one or another of these groups, it's because they've happened to mobilize the resources, the constituencies, and the networks necessary to wield this influence. But he also disagrees with the Leninist conception of the state as a mere instrument or tool of the ruling class, something that adheres to what the capitalist class wants to do. So he's touching on this idea that there is a relative autonomy of the state. That is, that yes, the most influential group within capitalist society tends to be the capitalist class, is the capitalist class. They have immense influence on state policy. But that does not mean that there aren't disagreements between them for a variety of reasons. First, capitalist class is not a homogeneous group. There are many different factions of the capitalist class. They are in competition with each other. They often have different political ideas about what society should be and how to achieve it. And they're not always in a seamless relationship with the state. The state is not a black box. It is not a homogeneous entity. It is also the site of different contending groups with their own ideas, their own policy networks or institutional affiliations or allegiances and the like. And there's nothing guaranteeing that the dominant factions of the capitalist class and the dominant factions of the political elites within governance have come up with the right strategies to actually impose their will on society. They can do things that open up space for a contestation, for resistance by forces who are not in the capitalist class, who are not in the ruling groups, the elite institutions, and the like. So I think we have to have a much more complex conception of the relationship between ruling classes and the state, in particular, just how dynamic and heterogeneous are the groups and institutions within it.
His name is Paul Christopher Gray. He teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University. We'll take a short break and speak more with Paul. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Paul Christopher Gray has a new book out. He's editor of From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. It's published by State University of New York Press. Paul teaches at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. So even given the heterogeneity of the society and the various factors and forces within it, you do stress in your introduction or in the chapter one of this book, Paul, which is kind of your critical introduction, you do stress the bias that nations that exist under capitalism have toward the capitalist class. And you point to what happens to the ability of, for example, socialist governments. So let's say a socialist party gets into power. The ability of socialist governments to fundamentally transform capitalist states in the face of what often turns into a hostile capitalist class. So what are the threats, or what actions can be and are taken by capitalists that may make it very problematic for a socialist government to carry out what it wants to do?
Well, I think one of the very real and significant criticisms that proponents of the anti-power politics group make about those attempts that so far have tried to change the world by taking power, one of the major criticisms they make is these attempts fall into what is called the social democratic trap. So often, socialist or certain variations of communist parties have been elected in periods of social and economic crisis, when people are looking for genuine alternatives. And these socialists and communist parties have a radical agenda, things that they would like to achieve, and it occurred time and time again that they would begin to introduce these reforms, and then when the moment of rupture with the existing system, with capitalism, arose, they stepped back. They did not move from reform to revolution. And ultimately, what they accomplish is saving capitalism from itself during periods of crisis and doing a little bit better than what liberal or conservative parties could have accomplished in that period when people were looking for alternatives. So the question becomes, why does the social democratic trap emerge? Why does it happen consistently to attempts to change the world by taking power? I think we should look at the state not as a institution that is neutral between different groups and classes within society. I think we should look at it as having three major biases. And it might help to think of this as a series of trenches. Each bias is a trench that is ever deeper than the one before it. And ultimately, any attempt to change the world by taking power will have to navigate all three of these trenches.
Okay, so three trenches, three levels of bias. One level of bias that you write about is interpersonal. What is interpersonal bias?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people who are the elites of political parties, who get elected, who are the politicians or the senior civil servants who are forming policy and implementing it, tend to come from elite groups, including the capitalist class. They are influenced by its ideas. They are socialized into its traditions, its customs, its ways of seeing things. As I put it in the introduction, members of the ruling classes, they are groomed. Members of the working class, they are only raised. And so anyone who would attempt to enter government and transform it in any significant way will have to contend with those groups who are not used to seeing policy or politics in anything broader than a largely liberal or conservative framework, and who will outright oppose any of these ideas by these groups.
The other two levels of bias are what you call institutional bias and systemic bias. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so the second bias and the second trench, which is much deeper than the first, is institutional bias. And that essentially means that it takes a lot of resources to get elected, to actually win election campaigns. And it takes a lot of resources and institutional connections to have influence, to make connections with those people who have been elected. And since ruling groups, members of the capitalist class, tend to have these resources and these institutional connections more than anybody else, they'll have more influence, and therefore government policy will be biased towards them. But these first two trenches, these first two forms of bias, do not come anywhere close to the obstacle that's created by the third trench, the systemic bias that exists in governments today. We should recall that in order to implement policies, governments are dependent on tax revenues. This is how they finance their policies. So typically, what has happened is in periods where socialists or communist parties have been elected, there's been an alliance within the working class and with other oppressed groups who vote these parties into power. Then these parties begin to implement the reforms that they've promised in their platform. Maybe they're going to increase wages. They're going to offer affirmative action policies. They're going to improve environmental standards. Maybe they're going to go so far as to nationalize certain industries or banking institutions. And at a certain point, what happens is the capitalist class, employers, shareholders, investors, decide that the current economic environment is not favorable toward profitability or their political interests. And because they own these companies as their own private property, they can decide what they do. So they stop investing resources into these companies, into the economy. So this creates downturns, and it can lead to economic crises. This also leads to a reduction in tax revenues, which, recall, is the basis by which any government in a capitalist society is going to implement its reforms, implement its policies. And so the combination of economic crises and the lack of implementation of government reforms tends to hit worst those constituencies who have voted for the socialist or communist parties that are currently in power. And given that they are hurt the most by these downturns, by these crises, then they tend to vote their parties out of power, hoping that there will be some amelioration of the effects of the downturn, the lack of investment in the economy. So one of the most significant points about this third bias, this third and deepest trench, is that even if political parties that are not members of the ruling class, the ruling elites, win government power, that does not mean that there aren't other ways of influencing government decisions outside of the government itself. And this is primarily a form of economic influence that ruling elites, the wealthy, the capitalist class, can have, even when their own parties are not ruling these governments. And typically, the third trench has always been the source of the social democratic trap. And any attempt to go beyond it, any attempt to genuinely transform society, will have to figure out how to navigate this third trench.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, that suggests that socialist and communist parties who are trying to gain power, trying to take power in a country, face a perhaps insurmountable obstacle if and when capitalists respond to their policies, their reforms, their proposed reforms with capital strikes, investment strikes, and capital flight. So what are you saying about what socialist parties who do vie for state power must do either before or after taking power to somehow counter this threat, to somehow react or respond to this threat, or maybe even head off the threat before it materializes?
Well, this is one of the major reasons why I am not entirely critical of either anti-power politics or those attempts to change the world by taking state power. This is why I think we have to try to reconcile the best aspects of those two traditions. Because what it means is that there are a variety of sources of power within society, not just in the state and not just beyond it. And so any attempt to fundamentally transform society, to democratize it, to make it more equal, will have to operate at these different sources of power simultaneously and have to be doing things in a more cooperative and cohesive strategy so that they can play off the strengths of each other. This is one of the reasons why I argued that a collective strategy, a long-term strategy, is so important. So any political party or political parties that would attempt to take office and transform society has to anticipate from the outset that they are going to provoke these kinds of confrontations with the capitalist class and with ruling elites. And if they want to go beyond a reformist agenda, if they're going to try to surmount this third trench, then they're going to have to develop the kind of politics that must already have been in place and developed to a significant degree before taking office is really a feasible project. If a political party that has taken office is implementing reforms, and suddenly a group of capitalist class, say in a major industry, decides to engage in a capital strike, they decide to withhold their investment, then the question arises, are we going to try to extend democracy beyond just the narrow confines of the realm of politics, beyond the narrow confines of parliamentary institutions? Is there the question of bringing these major industries into not only national control, but democratic control? Because if this government, in an attempt to prevent the worst aspects of this capital strike, simply nationalizes this industry, if they simply seize property ownership over this industry, that doesn't necessarily entail that it's any more democratic. It could be structured along the same lines that exist now, except instead of private employers, you have state employers, but still all the same hierarchies that exist. If you want to not only nationalize that industry, but to democratize it, there might already have to have been a series of reforms within that industry, namely around questions of workers' control. What is workers' control? Well, essentially, it's the idea that workers should not only struggle for things like higher wages, benefits, better hours, and the like, but for more participation in the major decisions of the companies for whom they work. And if they start prioritizing these kinds of demands in their collective bargaining or in their struggles with these companies, they begin to develop their own democratic capacities necessary to understand how the company or the corporation as an institution works, its connection to the economy. And so any political party that would attempt to not only take office, but to take power, to be able to surmount this third trench, the classic source of the social democratic trap, would probably have to be paralleled by broader attempts within the working class to not only fight for better wages, for more benefits and the like, but for workers' control, to have developed the capacities necessary to actually be able to run these industries if they are not only nationalized, but democratized.
And nationalization also means, as you write, challenging the system of private property, of private ownership of productive property.
That's right.
Paul Christopher Gray is his name. He is editor of the new book, From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. It's published by SUNY Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Paul, we've been talking a lot about what you have written in Chapter 1 of this book. It's called From the Streets to the State, A Critical Introduction. And you have been mentioning along the way some of the other contributions to this book. Can you give us a brief synopsis of at least some of the other essays, chapters in this book?
So I provide a critical introduction to some of the more general aspects of these questions. Then in the second chapter, Leo Panitch provides this long, arcing historical survey of the attempts by working class folks and their allies to democratize political parties, to democratize administration, and to democratize governance and the state. Then we move into particular case studies which look at the relations between political parties, social movements, government, and also the attempts to use law or legal mobilization as a way to win some of your demands and to create more leverage. So Davier LaFrance and Katarina Principe write about the new radical left parties in Western Europe. Tomas Chiasson-Labelle evaluates the rise and fall of the pink tide in Latin America. Kali Okuno looks at the relationship between cooperatives, people's assemblies, and the attempt to not only take office but take power by Chokwe Lumumba and the People's Assembly in Jackson, Mississippi. And Michael McCann and George Lavelle look at ways in which social movements can use lawyers and the law in a way that does not allow them to dominate those social movements and to rely too much on litigation strategies. We then shift to the question of democratic administration. Greg Elbow provides a sweeping survey of the major traditions of administration and how democratic administration provides an alternative that is more just. Then Hillary Wainwright looks at a number of case studies by public sector workers and radical left political parties to not only expand the public sector, but to improve services in a way that empowers user groups rather than just passively giving them services. Tammy Finley offers her theory of what she calls femocratic administration. And then finally, Greg McElliott asks a very difficult question. We've talked about democratizing administration in things like the public sector. What would it mean to try to address the hierarchy and lack of democracy within some of the more coercive institutions of the state? And so he asks, what might the relationship be between prison reform and prison abolition and prison guards and cooperatives within prisons? And he uses Italy as a case study.
Paul Christopher Gray. He teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University in Canada, and he is editor of the new book. It's called From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. Paul, thanks for putting together this book and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.